So last night we celebrated the relaunch of Festival Hall here in Melbourne, where we are now, here at Small Time Studios. So it only makes sense that we welcome back Live Nation's Asia Pacific President, Roger Field, back on the podcast. So Roger first appeared on the Fear at the Top podcast back in 2018, and he detailed how he got into the music business and ended up leading the Australian division for the most powerful concert promoter on the planet. It was a great episode, so if you go back and listen to it, I think you'll really enjoy it. But for now, welcome back, Roger.
Thank you. Great to be back. Great to have you down in Melbourne as well, hometown.
Yeah, well, we came here for the Festival Hall relaunch. Congrats on that. That was an excellent event last night.
It was a great night. What can I say? There was so much love in the room. The industry coming together, having fun, top quality band performance, great venue to have back on the agenda. And I think it couldn't have gone better. So we're really, really pleased that it's back in profile, in front of people's minds, and they're talking about the fun times they've had there instead of what's been a challenging couple of years on the whole.
And we need Festival Hall, we need that venue, and we need it in that area too. Do you have a vision for that area as a music precinct or something like that?
I always have visions. Whether or not they're practical is the challenge. The thing about that venue, and it was great to actually be able to take Danny Pearson, who's the assistant treasurer, and he was representing the government. He's a massive, as Zan called him, gig pig. So he actually does go to shows. And so it was great to be able to walk him around and explain some of the nuances and challenges of the space. It's a functionally boxing design, and it's a very old design. So none of the things that we look for in venues now as far as open spaces and foyers and things like that were considered. You sort of went in, you walk through the door. For those who haven't been there, you're in the performance space. So we have this sort of weird situation where the on one side of the door is either a transport or City of Melbourne land, and then the other side is you're in the room. So I would love to be able to work collaboratively with everyone to really address what's been an issue with it for a very long time and create some reason for people to go down there early. And in particular, we've talked a lot about the cultural significance, and there's so much great archival stuff that we dug up for the launch, which is not collated anywhere in particular. You know, Frank Sinatra being chased by the media down the side in 1974, the Beatles performance. After I did a couple of interviews yesterday, some of the radio stations had people call in with memories. This huge Melbourne wrestling scene with all these great characters, and that's not documented anywhere. So the other opportunity, which we want to pursue in the short term, is to actually create some sort of an homage to that cultural history, because there's no point in talking about cultural relevance if there's nothing there to let people know how deep it runs. And that's the biggest weakness of that particular place at the moment.
And you need government help to do that too.
We do, and we need it particularly because we don't have any space to do it. So, but as a performance space goes, Melbourne has been generally quite good at keeping these venues intact. We have most of our picture theatres still operating, but you can't replace the feel of a place like that just with a new building. It's a great shame to consider losing something like that and then not have a plan to replace it or upgrade it. And the Melbourne concert scene and the entertainment scene has been wanting for that venue. I think that's why people were so sad at the prospect of it actually being redeveloped into apartments. That's what kicked the whole thing off. So we're expecting it'll be welcomed because it's just such a different feel seeing a show there. It's such a different feel, and a lot of those memories hark back to big day outside shows, and everyone played that venue on the way up to Rod Laver or stadiums. You know, the Coldplay, JT, Kanye, AC/DC even played there on the way up. So it's going to hopefully have a long future.
And it's a very understanding move by Live Nation to do that with Festival Hall. You have a thing called Venue Nation. That's a whole division of the business. So can you tell me a little bit about that and also why it's important for Live Nation to operate venues in that way? Were there challenges in the past when Live Nation locally wasn't operating the venues?
I think it harks back to recognising where there are gaps. And I think Australian cities, cities around the world, especially cities in the Asia Pacific region, are fairly under serviced in a range of venue sizes. I think Sydney's got a big problem. The arenas, the most recently developed arena was in 2000, which was Kudos Bank Arena. Actually, Perth RAC Arena was developed since then. That was, I can't remember when that opened. I think it was maybe 2006 or something like that. But those sorts of developments are few and far between, and patron habits change and technology improves. And what we're seeing in North America and around the world is a lot of that technology is changing the fan experience. You know, whether it's the ability to walk into a retail outlet and Marvel Stadium's just installed this, the technology to register, and then you walk into an outlet, grab something off the shelf, you walk out and you're automatically debited for it. And I think that our ability to evolve the scene is limited by the lack of venues and the gaps. So I think the strategy of the business has really changed since we last spoke to focus on the venue opportunities. We are a vertical business, and but the unique thing that we bring is we're first and foremost a content provider. And what that does, especially in a market like Australia, is it gives us the foundation stone of feasibility for a venue. And I don't think that's really existed before. The venues have been developed by either as government assets, or they've been private assets open for booking. I think what we are able to bring is obviously know-how and content. And a lot of the things that we've already addressed in somewhere like Festival Hall were niggles as a hirer that made the hirer experience more challenging. And so I think that is a critical part of our strategy going forward, and will continue to be a focus. And we're being given all of the presidents and leaders in the business have been given immense opportunity to free range in finding these opportunities. And you know, yes, arenas are great. We're definitely in the arena game, but we're still investing in small venues. We've obviously, since we spoke, we already operated the Palais Theatre, but since then we've picked up Anita's in Thirroul. Now that's not a cap city, but it's a vibrant music market. It's a viable venue. We've opened the Fortitude Music Hall, much needed in Brisbane. Hindley Street Music Hall in Adelaide. The government in South Australia was thrilled to have something like that going to Hindley Street, because it needs some rejuvenation. It's a night strip, and what we've seen happen with the Fortitude in Brisbane is Brunswick Street Mall has changed dramatically because of the variety of patrons that are coming along to that part of town, and then it gives us the opportunity to engage with bands that we're not necessarily touring, fans that aren't necessarily just coming to the shows we're promoting. So it ties all of the loose ends together. So that's a huge part of what I do every day, which is really exciting. It adds a really, really great dimension. And I love heritage, so the ability to be supported by a company that lets us do something like pick up the phone and say, hey, what's happening with Festival Hall, or pick up Anita's and keep that going is really it's a dream.
You mentioned that there were a lot of niggles trying to book rooms before you owned your own venues. What were they?
There's just I think there's a lack of availability generally. It's well proven in any sort of business that you need to open markets up to create markets. So I think even now the business is booming back. It's fantastic. But trying to book venues in most of the cap city markets, some venues are running five or six pencil bookings deep for dates, and they're all real bookings. And what happens when you can't get the date is you end up having to rejig or remove things. And we've already seen tours just not be able to get an itinerary together in the region and just move by months, and in some cases years. And so that I think is the first sort of obvious niggle that everyone has. And I think we're missing a trick in Australia generally at opening up some of our regional centres. New South Wales and Queensland have done a reasonable job in having secondary non-cap city markets for live entertainment. But Victoria is terrible. There's not a great venue in Geelong. The catchment area of Geelong has grown exponentially. And whereas you've got venues in Newcastle or Wollongong. So I think we have to be creating more performance opportunities, especially for international bands to make it feasible to come here, but also for Aussie acts to get around and get to new markets. And I think that's a testament to things like Spilt Milk or Groove in the Moo, and others that play non-cap city centres. There's clearly demand there, so what are we doing about that on a venue front? And then secondarily, when you're a hirer or a band and you go into a venue, you experience different challenges to what the venue might have, and particularly with Festival Hall, you know, but I think a lot of venues, there's a tendency to think, well, that's just the way it is. You as the venue operator don't necessarily understand why that's an issue.
Sorry, be specific. What's the issue?
Well, I think I'll use the examples of what we've changed at Festival Hall. You know, the roof used to be white panels, those sort of false ceiling blocks you see in an office, and it costs the venue a lot to change something like that to paint it. Does it make the venue unusable? No. Is there money in it for the venue? No. But does it make the show better? Yes, because instead of when the lights go up on stage, it reflecting off this massive white roof, the roof's painted black, which it is now. The focal point is the stage. And that was, before I got on stage last night and said anything, that was the first thing people noticed, or people were coming up to me and saying something's different. And I said, the roof's black. And that we learnt from our arena in Auckland when Stuart Klumpus, our partner, took it over. He was very much for the fan, for the show, even to the point where he would, you know, do things like have an argument with the production manager about putting the house lights up too quickly after the show, jolting people out of the moment. And one of the things that he did was paint the walls and the roof black. And that was where I sort of learned that that's a really obvious thing you start to notice when you're in a venue and you've got the distractions around you from the stage. The other thing which I absolutely hated at Festival Hall, on the one occasion that I ended up with seats on the left or right side, I won't mention the act or which manager put me there, but it had wire running across it. Again, practical for the venue, because what it did was it stopped people jumping the fence onto the floor. But really terrible experience for about a third of the audience. You felt completely dislocated from the show. Now, that's a really simple thing to change. It doesn't cost any money. Yes, we probably will have to encounter that problem or address that problem at some point, but there are other ways to do it. And I think if you're able to approach those sorts of things from the onstage or the fan perspective and not just what the venue does or doesn't need to do, that's a pretty unique proposition.
So lots of demand to go into very few venues. Were you at a competitive disadvantage because, unlike America, the dominant ticket player here is Ticketek, which is run by TEG, not your business. Do you often end up getting, if it's a line ball on who gets the gig, you guys miss out? Is that a common problem in the industry?
No, it's not. I think there's a misconception around particularly venue, who manages or who operates a venue, that the book's not open to all hirers. It needs to be open to all hirers. We get exactly the same treatment, or our promoters, I should say, our concerts division get the same treatment in booking our venues as every other hirer. And in fact, some of our venues, we're not the biggest hirer year on year, which we address every time because we need to maintain that. But a venue in this country particularly has to be used by all, you know, all potential hirers to be feasible. And that's just a fact. And the booking system we have for our venues is exactly the same as all of the other venues in the way that that inventory is managed. Some of the venues might have a bit more of a tactical approach as to what sort of shows they might book on certain nights because of how they think it might sell or whatever, you know, but that's again canvassed across all hirers. I think the ticketing side of things is, you know, it's, I don't think it prevents anyone getting shows. The ability to ticket through your own company is obviously great. It gives you more potential revenue to play with. Everything that we do globally is about trying to pay the artists more and pass that through. And we're a volume business, so the way we roll is by picking up, you know, little bits of a lot of things and a lot of volume. The big, I think, difference between the ticketing offering is really, it comes down to the technology and the marketing and capability. And I think the benefit that we have is a lot of our innovation is driven by really big players like the NFL in the US. And so we have the benefit down here of being able to leverage a lot of those products. And that's what we particularly like about being able to use our company Ticketmaster, because we end up yielding much more for the artist because of a lot of the pricing strategies and a lot of the tools and tech that are there. But we are also arguably the biggest user of Ticketek, because Ticketek ticket all of the arenas. We have a functional, good working relationship with them. I catch up with Cameron Hoy. I speak with Jeff Jones often. No, any ticketing company that tells you that they don't have a problem is not telling the truth. They all have their technical issues. They all have little nuances. But I don't feel that in any way dictates who does or doesn't get a show or misses out from the promoter perspective. And we'll obviously favour where we can our other parts of our businesses for the reasons that I touched on, but we have no issue, you know, we have no issue using the ticketing provider that's attached to a venue as long as it's a robust system and it actually delivers what we need, which is to sell the ticket. Because I think that anything that blocks the connection between our consumer or the artist's customer and us, it directly impacts our ability to sell the ticket and to retail and do what we need to do. So all systems are good as long as they're robust and they deliver what we need.
Can I ask about that reinvestment of that money that you get from using Ticketmaster? Because I know that Live Nation is very much about investing in audience and also investing in artist development too. So have you had any global wins for Australian or Kiwi artists that you can talk about that Live Nation has done with a bit of that reinvestment?
We haven't, it's an area we need to work on. We've launched things like Ones to Watch, in Australia and through Asia, with the purpose of using that as our adoption, and exposure tool for Australian, New Zealand and Asian artists. We haven't had any big wins on global deals with Aussie acts. And I think that's been, It's probably testament to getting the concept going, which it is definitely going, and we have, you know, we've got artists that we've worked with, like Dua Lipa, who we've been able to, because of a bigger partnership, bring down here to do the Northcote Social Club, to just get the taste into the market when it wasn't financially feasible to do shows at that level, but it was important as part of the strategy of developing her profile. And we've done that with 21 Pilots and a bunch of others. And I think that we now have an understanding of how to do that with incoming international acts, and we're able to push our offices overseas to do the same with an act that, you know, might be doing quite well here. But isn't big enough to look at it just on a pure feasibility basis in their market. We've changed up our through COVID our strategy on global talent, which has been it's pretty revolutionary, because it's giving our promoters more latitude to build their relationship with an act globally and not have them deal with XYZ in market XYZ. So I think we're going to see more of it. We are pulling the content that we are generating from Ones to Watch down here. It's actually automatically pulling into the US Ones to Watch site. That's a key component of why we've done that.
What does that mean? Sorry, pulling. And maybe for listeners who aren't sure of your Ones to Watch project, maybe could you explain a little bit about that?
It's a brand that was it's a discovery brand that was developed in the US, and it's supported by marketing. It's supported by our venues, and it has a web portal where performances from the Ones to Watch showcases can be viewed or accessed, and it's a discovery piece. And what it allows us to do is get brand partners or sponsors to help us with the feasibility to own it. Labels own it; they can own showcases, and it has four or five artists appear that are quite different or the same in respect of, are they with the same label or are they same sort of style? We record it, we do social media push behind it. We've got a tour support component that we're adding in this market. And then that content goes onto our Ones to Watch platform locally. But then the US has the ability to then pull content from other Ones to Watch sites around the region into the US Ones to Watch portal.
Cool.
So people, and we can pull US artists back down here. So it relies on a frequency of consumers going there to discover and potentially see something they didn't go there to see. And a particular opportunity that we've identified and working on is getting Asia artist talent down here using that, and then pushing Australian New Zealand talent up into Asia as well, because the region's tied together as well. We can execute that sort of regional touring feasibility quite well locally, and then start to grow that into a bigger global picture. The adoption of Asia artist music, particularly K-pop, and then I think there's massive opportunity in the Mando and Kanto pop space as well. I think we're going to see a lot more of people going and exploring that genre and that world, and then opening, you know, to my point, opening new markets, actually getting them to start touring down here. And I think Australian artists have missed a trick a little bit by not taking Asia seriously. It's a massive market.
Is it not taking Asia seriously, or is it don't know how to fucking do it?
I don't think it's been a priority.
Okay.
I think North America, UK, Europe is obviously a priority, but they're notoriously hard markets to break. And there are artists that we've worked with, like Lainey, who've really committed to the region. And we just did a Lainey tour, and they did five sold out Mall of Asia arenas in Manila.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's 50,000 people that came and saw Lainey. You know, that's their biggest market in Asia, and that's because they committed to the market and they went through. And I think Australian artists have sort of focused on further afield areas. Also, instead of looking at all of the markets in Asia, are very, very different as to what music they're into and what taste they have. So I think the other thing is possibly been seeing Asia as a whole group of, you know, homogenous markets potentially, and not thinking, hey, I think this music would work well in Singapore and maybe Bangkok, so why don't we hit that on the way to Europe? What we bring as well is the feasibility to actually look at doing that seriously. So venues, again, we come back to, there's a real shortage of venues in all throughout Asia. So we've got some venues that are under development at the moment that sort of fit into that 2,000 to 5 or 6,000 capacity, which I think will make it a lot easier for, again, us to drive our artists in there to make the venue feasible. But also there'll be more turnkey, so it's more cost effective. And I think international artists are getting their head around adapting their show to move through Asia. The massive coup that we have with Coldplay playing Perth exclusively was just because Coldplay, to play Asia, have to be moving show around with air freight. They're already in the air freight mentality. And so adding Perth to Asia made sense because It's the same distance, but probably a lot easier to get from Singapore to Perth and back into Asia than it is to get from the east coast of Australia. So I think Australian artists need to start to look at that part of the world really seriously. And I hope they come and talk to us about how we can start to tie what is generally for Australian artists really good at touring business down here into pivoting it up into Asia as well, because the feasibility of a lot of things touring Asia is based on Australia and New Zealand. And that's, I think that's beginning to sink in. And I think part of the success in doing that will then mean that potentially we can start to grow those deals into including North America and other markets. But we're absolutely desperate to break an Aussie act under a global development deal. So if anyone's listening to this.
Well, speaking of breaking Australian acts as well, when you were talking about ones to watch, you reminded me of a conversation I had at the Festival Hall relaunch, actually. Someone told me that at the Melbourne Ones to Watch one, where Boy Soda, Pania and Mitch Santiago performed, as the music industry is known to do, when we get in a room, we love to get a little bit chatty. We're spoiled for choice when it comes to gigs, so we sometimes forget what a privilege it is to watch live music. And apparently the industry was so chatty that you got up on stage and said that you would give each artist an extra $10,000 if everyone shut the fuck up for three songs. Is that right? Is that true?
It's true. I was really getting very embarrassed, actually, for the industry, we haven't seen each other for a long time. I get that. But I really felt for the artists that were up there in a room full of industry tastemakers, and that they're, you know, really, really, you know, exposing themselves, and people were just so chatty. And I think it was a little ad hoc. I think a few people running around as I did it, but it was the only way I could think of to actually, it was particularly because Mitch had played first, and we were getting to the last couple, and I felt really bad for Mitch. So I just wanted to make sure they actually got something out of it as well. But it's turned into something that's positive, because, you know, that tour support, that's where we want to be building relationships. And it wasn't just throwing money, it was genuine tour support, allowing them to some of them have mounted tours with it, some of them have invested in going overseas, and we're doing the shows overseas, and then we've also got all our marketing channels. And that's a component that we will more structurally build into the concept going forward. Again, that's a learning as well, because it's great for us to be doing the discovery piece with Ones to Watch, but we still are miles away from the rest of the world. So, and we want to foster these relationships here as well. Not enough Australian bands, in my opinion, use a promoter in their home country, and I think that they leave opportunity on the table because of that. Because
why do you think that, though?
Because there's no one. On their behalf, exposed to risk. And what I mean by that is, I think that it's a really challenging proposition for an artist to have to focus on the creative side, but then also have to go out and figure out how to bankroll their tour, the logistics of putting the tour together, marketing it. I think that there's good value in a separation between church and state in that respect. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a job to do. Tony Harlow, when he ran Warner years ago, he and I, we had great success with Warner Music when Tony was there, because Tony said, we all have a job to do, and we all need to just do our jobs and not try and do everything else. And so the approach we had with 21 Pilots, the approach we had with Dua Lipa, the label played a huge part, the agent played a huge part, and the promoter played a huge part.
So that's clear to me, but why do you think managers go, oh, I'm just going to do it myself, I don't want to work with a promoter, I don't want to work with TEG or Live Nation or whatever? What is that mental barrier in your mind?
I think they take a fairly myopic view of another percentage going to someone else. It's understandable when you're trying to balance up the whole thing. But I think they're not seeing that if you have a commitment from a promoter in the form of the way the offer's structured, which then gives you the bedrock of the funding to bankroll the tour you're then going to put together. So then you can start to design.
So just
a show
using
you
layman's
see.
Terms, you're saying a promoter will take on all the risk, or they'll give you an advance, and they'll give you all these resources and team and a marketing team and a, and this and that and blah blah blah, and handle all that heavy lifting.
Yeah, if you're doing it yourself, you don't have any foundation. So you're going to invest all of this money in developing a show and booking gear and, you know, booking venues, paying deposits. But you don't have any money until you've sold ticket one. Whereas the way it generally works with the promoter is the promoter will give you a committed amount of money, a guarantee. And then depending on how the deal's structured, some sort of coverage on the costs. And then, and I'm putting this in very basic terms, industry people know what I'm talking about. But then they will, you know, and everything gets signed off by the artist as well. So this is not like you give your rights away and the promoter just goes and books the gear they want to and whatever else. Hmm. Everything's done in collaboration with the artist. And then they will go out and be aggressive in market to sell every one of those tickets to get that upfront commitment back. Instead of there being a conversation where a manager has to decide whether or not they can afford to do another campaign marketing because they don't know whether or not they're going to sell any tickets. If a promoter's behind the eight ball on the costs, or even if the promoter's into percentage and making margin, you know, that margin's small, so they'll push it harder to try and get to get more tickets sold. I think some of it's complacency and a little bit of an unwillingness to change from the norm. I think there's probably resistance from some of the other parties in the chain of process as to how they're going to generate their money. But I think if you're really serious about becoming a big band here and then going internationally, there's great merit in working with a promoter.
So let me give you an opportunity to rebut a manager's objections. So I feel like there are two types of managers. There's the one manager who appreciates outsourcing to experts, happy to pay the fee, happy to do a lot less work and fucking just let the promoter deal with it, and that's good. That's a no-brainer. I'd say majority managers. Then there's the other manager who says, why am I going to give not Live Nation, any promoter, $500,000 cut of my tour? I'm going to have to, I don't think that they're going to be as creative with the marketing. They get frustrated that maybe there's juniors doing the marketing or the marketing team's so spread thin that they're not going to come up with too much creative stuff. And I also am worried that they're getting kickbacks and markups on every line item, and I'm getting skinned when I on things that I didn't sign off on. So to me, that is probably the main objection that those fewer managers have. What would your response be to that?
Well, we can all go around being suspicious of everything and never do anything. Mm. I think that it's. I think for a start to look at the specific examples, you know, our marketers market Coldplay right down to club shows. The majority of them have got industry background, but they're also playing in a big media landscape. We did an upfront, which is a media term for basically showing your wares to the industry. I've been to a couple of the TV station up front. So Nathan and our marketing team had the idea of us actually talking about us to agencies, and we had all of the major TV, all of the print, all of the online there, and we've got the ability to be talking about stadium tours, but also the developing artist side, the venues, ones to watch and so on, and they're really engaged. So the way I'd flip that around is to say that when you work with a promoter like us or Frontier or TEG, you're getting access to this volume of and range of associated content that you can leverage off. The, you know, we have 7 million unique views of our website at the moment. We email five million people a year or something like that. Well, no, we send 50 million emails a year. You have the ability to be seen alongside some of those acts that people are definitely going to open the email or come to our Instagram page for. And so I think you get benefits.
Huge assets to leverage off.
Yeah, and we're booking stages every day of the week. We're booking PA every day of the week. So, yes, we do a huge amount of volume, but that means better deals across the board. It means more, we can take more risk. So I think that all of those inputs ultimately end up leading to the artist side being able to focus on what they need to be focused on. And yeah, if that's digging in deep with our marketing team as to what the marketing is and how they want it to look, that's totally up to them. Mm. We have managers that are deeply, deeply engaged in everything we do marketing wise, and we have some that we work with regularly that just let us do our thing. As I said, every single thing we do is done in collaboration with the agent and manager, signed off, all the pricing, all the marketing. And then at the end of the tour, all of the invoices back up all of the things that we've spent money on, because it's ultimately the artist's money. There's always going to be that small margin.
Mm.
That's their choice. That's fine.
And I will say two things to that, if I can help be a counter argument as well. Not speaking for every promoter, but my experience with Live Nation marketing team in particular, I found really inspiring. I mean, Poppy and I were just meeting, like Nathan Thompson, we meet him every time we come down to Melbourne. The whole marketing team seems super ambitious and think outside the box of Live Nation. So that's a credit to you and the team you built there. And I've got a high standard when it comes to marketers. So I'll say that with confidence. The other thing about the margins thing and, you know, promoters clipping the ticket and all of that, whether it's disclosed or not, I find it really interesting to say, okay, yes, even if there's clips happening, whatever, let's assume that there is, right, for the sake of the argument, Live Nation's margin, as I understand it globally as a business, is like 12%. If you compare that to a company like Apple, who are like closer to 30%, you know, it's actually just not a high margin business. So if you want a whole team of people to help on your tour and you want all of this sort of support, you know, they're only on a 12% margin. So it's like, you know, the penny pinching mentality, I think if you think, hey, I can execute this and do it myself better, that's your right. Cool. But if you think there's just like private jets being flown around because of your specific Enmore tour, I think it's a bit, you know, I think it's a bit misguided in my view. And that would be my personal take on it.
Yeah, and I think it's other areas as well. You know, we have some of the most dynamic ticketing experts who are moving inventory around the houses all the time, all with the intention of creating greater uplift for the artist and selling tickets at higher prices. I think that we have hundreds of people who are working on our tours, and they all are learning as they go from other tours and other things that artists are doing. So you're getting into that ecosystem of thought, you know, thought motivation. I don't want to promote another podcast, but Michael Rapino just did Bob Lefsetz's podcast.
Great podcast. Listen to it. Yeah. It's awesome.
And, you know, Lefsetz is as challenging an interviewer as there is. You know, his first words to me when I was on a panel with him was, "So what's it like to be the devil?" It was a good way for Bob to start.
Wow. Are you telling me to up my game right here?
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Scrap take the gloves off. Questions.
No, but I think Michael goes into some really fascinating detail, which I'm not even going to try and repeat because I don't want to get it wrong. But it's a great masterclass in what happens with the ticket and what our margins are across the verticals. We make different. We make different money from different verticals, and the area we make the least out of is concerts. Mm. But it's all of those other inputs, and it's the volume game. So
just to summarize it, so on the podcast, Michael says that he makes anywhere between 2-4% on the concert. He makes 35% on brands. He makes another percentage on parking and all that sort of stuff. And overall, if you average it out, it's 12%.
Yeah.
And he talks about the Live Nation business surviving because of huge volume, not off any one tour. And it's kind of like a river of nickels.
That's right. And the other thing, the other point I'd make on Australian artists is the reason I can't quite get my head around why they see this differently is they're quite happy to go and do deals with labels that run multi-albums, multi-years, and the label exercises creative influence and a lot more control than we do on touring. So what I see is the missed opportunity in not working with someone like us or Frontier, or I'm being agnostic here, is you don't have the ability to sit down and talk about a multi-year strategy. You just don't. And I think that that's a really odd way to do business, is not to be collaborating and putting together a strategy where you potentially are going to get income guaranteed, so you can really start to evolve that creativity for more years. And I'm not trying to dumb down the way managers are thinking. I'm sure they're thinking about strategy, but I think there's something to be added by being able to go to a touring expert and include them in the strategy along with the label and anyone else.
I think it's the difference between seeing your promoter as a buyer versus a partner. So some would see a partner, some would see it as a buyer, and I think you'd see the two different behaviours operate that way, yeah.
I wanted to talk about the Chug and Frontier consolidation that happened. Mm-hmm. So we had them on the Fear at the Top as well, and they said that really one of the reasons why they consolidated and joined forces was so that they could compete on the same level as Live Nation Australia and New Zealand. And so I wondered if, since that consolidation, have you noticed an increase in the tours that you've lost to Frontier? Has it worked, basically?
Let me just clarify that the concept that Live Nation was the only multinational invested in Australian promoters for you know the 10 years that I've been working here is absolute furphy. There's been multinational.
Never heard that term before. Furphy.
Furphy. It's an Aussie term. It's also good beer. I think it's CUB. Yeah. It's absolute right. I find it hilarious that an industry that talks so much amongst itself has not acknowledged what's actually going on in the background. Multinational companies have been invested in the Australian music scene and promoters for a long time, whether or not anyone wants to accept it. And subsequently, the pipeline of content, okay, yes, if we do
it. Who's investing with who?
Well, Frontier have always been aligned with getting AEG content. Now, that's not taking any credit away from Michael, Matt, Susan. I love them all. I get on really well with them. They're great promoters, but we're great promoters too. If you have a global deal and the act comes to this market and says, that promoter's terrible, I don't want to use them again, then you haven't done a good job. So I think that it's been a real positive for the industry that there's been multinational interest in the business and businesses here, because A, it shows the market is highly viable. B, it shows that there are really good operators that international companies or private equity funds or whatever want to partner with and invest in because they see growth. And C, it's actually opened up more content because we're seen as a critical part of the world now in a global frame. So I don't think there's been any increase in win or loss. I think that the Chug and Frontier thing coming back together was just a great story of a partnership that was strong and robust, that separated slightly, coming back together. But the positives out of that is we've had a new generation like Susan come through. Susan wasn't ever part of the Frontier ecosystem, I don't think, while Chug and Chug was part of Frontier. So you sort of split the trunk of the tree and you get new shoots. And so I think that it's certainly made the industry a lot more dynamic and a lot more feisty. But there's other good new product that's coming up as well, new festivals, new promoters. And we've seen that some of them are getting very big in their own right. But there'll always be multinational interest down here, and it's something I think that should be embraced and not warded off.
So let's talk festivals then. Last time we spoke on the podcast, you just bought Splendor. Majority stake in Secret Sounds, they own Splendor. Last year, together with Secret Sounds, you bought Spilt Milk. What about the Splendor acquisition did you learn post the last 4 years? What were the learnings out of that, and how did you apply those learnings to, say, Spilt Milk? Did you make any mistakes up here and then change the way that you did the deal with Spilt Milk?
I don't think we made any. I wouldn't say we made any mistakes. You learn a lot all the time. I think back to when I first did this podcast and what I've personally and professionally been through, like everybody, and what's happened in that time. I guess a key learning is constantly bringing a new perspective into the business is great and it's important. And I think the ability to work closely with Jess and Paul and the Secret Sounds team has been really, really good for the whole of the Live Nation business as it's sort of built up organically, and having another integrated business come in that has a different perspective and a different different set of strategic imperatives has been invaluable. And it's created, in some respects, a good bit of competitive tension to work through as well. You know, Secret Sounds are their promoters in their own right. They obviously have the festivals. We have some of our own festivals. And that competitive tension initially is sort of, you know, it's been a bunch of atoms whacking around in a...
You're not trying to outbid each other?
No, but there's always... I mean, promoters are competitors.
Yeah.
You know, we quite often have to stand over a couple of our own promoters that are fighting over something or who saw it first or whatever else. And one of the things we've had to do over time is actually get the promoters to, hey, why don't you both work on it? just stop bickering and carrying on, because it's distracting the work you've got to do. And there's certainly been some of those instances from the Secret Sounds perspective. But that brand is a different brand and look and feel to Live Nation. It's a different sort of... It's a different perspective for an artist to be projected out to their audience, and that's a good thing that we can offer. Do you want column A or column B? So personally, I've learnt a lot about how to collaborate and when to just let something, you know, it's not a big deal, back down, or hey guys, let's stop talking internally and let's deal with the competitive imperatives outside. I think that the addition of Jeff and Ryan and the Spilt Milk team has been great, because that's also that they have something that works, and they're doing what I said earlier, they're opening new markets up. And so I think I'd add to that I've learned through a few hard knocks that, you know, you starting something big from scratch is not necessarily going to work, and trying to copy something that someone else is doing well is almost never going to work. So I think identifying those opportunities, but then also maintaining that just let them keep doing what they're doing is really important, and treat what we can offer as a support service.
Additive.
As an additive, as counsel, if you want to ask me about a decision that you or anyone else in the business about a decision you're going to make for an opinion, and you don't agree with the opinion, you don't have to do what I suggested or someone else suggested. But I think I'd like to think that it's opened, it's been positive for the other side as well to get access to all of the assets that we have, not only the physical assets, but the intellectual property within our business. Because if you are introduced to people in other countries, in other markets that work in our business, there's an immense amount of knowledge there, and I think we had an APAC meeting in Singapore at the start of the year, and we got a bunch of our US touring guys to come to Singapore to focus on this part of the world, and took all of our promoters up there, and the Splendor and Spilt Milk guys came up as well, and that ability to be part of that team, we had our phenomenal co-MDs in Korea, Stephen and Yongbae, come to that meeting and talk about K-pop. The volume of K-pop now touring the world as just pop, you know, it's to have your mind opened up to that and to be able to talk about the strategy around that, and then how to integrate something like K-pop and Mandopop onto festival lineups down here. I think those are the really exciting things that we've been able to open up. But generally, just let everyone continue to move in their, you know, in the way they've been going, and just try and provide the support at the times that they need it.
So I'm a big believer in show me the incentive and I'll show you the behavior, or I'll tell you the behavior. And so when you acquire business owners, entrepreneurs, Ryan and Jeff at Secrets at Spilt Milk and Jess and Paul at Splendor, their incentive was super clear when they were by themselves. It's fucking them against the world, their business, their money on the line, everything. And then you acquired a majority stake in them, and their incentive changes, if not if not at least it changes by 51%. So I'm going to guess that you've put both parties on earnouts and things like that to keep them commercially incentivized to keep going. Is that correct?
I'm taking that as a statement, not a question.
Okay. So assuming that's the case, what is the plan after the earnouts are hit? And are you worried about losing, you know, that magic that Jess and Paul had or that the Spilt Milk guys had after earnouts? Like, how does Live Nation ensure that Splendor in the Grass is still going to be here in 20 years and still be as magical as it is right now?
They still have motivation through incentive. The reality is that the reason we don't like to buy 100% or partner 100% in a business is because we do want the original owners of the business to still have a vested interest and still be motivated by exactly the same factors. No deal is the same as well. Mm-hmm. No motivation is the same, and so no incentive is the same. So all the parts of our business are incentivized in some way, shape or form, because you're exactly right. People have to be, especially the ringer that people get put through every year, just with the peaks and troughs. And so I think that the ability to incentivize doesn't end at the end of whatever a term is. There's always a deal to be done. They're not that different to artists, a lot of the principal entrepreneurs. But the spark that they still have is the entrepreneurial side of things. So if I can use a practical example, apart from the Trifford, Secret Sounds didn't really have any sort of venue profile. Paul particularly is passionate about venues. He wants to get in there, and he's a little like Stuart Klumpus, who I mentioned before at Spark Arena. He wants to get in there and get into the fan experience and fill that gap of the sort of venue that he always wanted to go to that wasn't there. So the ability for such a big development over the time that we were able to do it around Fortitude Music Hall and Hindley Street Music Hall, I think is something that we've brought to Paul's entrepreneurial flair to be able to continue to stay engaged, because the entrepreneur never leaves. So I fervently believe we give those entrepreneurs opportunities to do a lot more things more quickly and have a lot more ideas realised. And I think we've got examples of that around the world, where we have businesses that you know, we own 100% now, but they still maintain their own identity, they still maintain their own motivation, because just homogenizing everything is not the way to long-term success and growth. Just isn't. Mm. It just becomes boring, and it becomes low in motivation, and you're not challenging people to change the way they think, so they just do everything the same. And I think if we took that approach and didn't have people pushing the boundaries all the time, then we wouldn't be on a very, very, very good path.
If I look at the three big promoters in Australia, I don't believe any promoter has successfully created a new festival that's had long-standing success, like a big IP like Splendor or Blues Fest or whatever. Obviously, the acquisition strategy is successful and works really well. What do you think about the big promoter setup doesn't foster the ability for a promoter to just start something from fresh and build it up into a Spilt Milk or a Blues Fest or something like that?
In the festival space specifically?
Yeah, in the festival space.
And we're talking Australia, right?
Yeah, like, in Australia.
Obviously, Live Nation has Life is Beautiful, and that's...
Yeah, I think... Well, what's the definition of the festival is the first thing, right? Because I think, you know, the global definition of a festival is multi-day, multi-stage camping. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some festivals in Australia that don't necessarily fit that bill, but we still call them festivals. And so I think the term festival gets sort of thrown around pretty loosely. I think there are not many iconic festivals of the standing of Lollapalooza or Splendor or Download in every market anyway. So I guess my consideration is, well, you know, would we ever expect that there might be more than one or two of those? But to your question about the promoter, I've learnt the hard way with my partner in crime, Michael Koppel, particularly, that trying to create and execute a festival out of a concert promoter office is impossible, hard, not going to work.
Why?
Because I think you have to have your DNA in the idea, and it has to be a 12-month of the year proposition and an obsession. And you know, that's what Splendor is for Jess, and Paul, particularly Jess. That's what Spilt Milk is for Ryan and Jeff. You know, as soon as the project's done for the year, they're already deep into the project for the next year. Whereas a concert promoter at the level of TEG, Frontier or us is having things thrown at them left, right and centre. Whether it's, you know, someone like Drake deciding that, you know, he wants to announce a tour that'll play out in 6 weeks, or it's a massive, you know, a massive event announced like Coldplay in Perth, but then you've got to still get this club show on sale, and then you've got to go down to, you know, you've got to go down to the Palais because you've got one of your artists on tour at that time. You're not thinking.
Issue.
Well, you're not thinking about the festival that's happening in 3 months. And in my experience personally, when those things have come around, you go, "Oh shit, that festival's like 2 months away. We better start thinking about that. Has anyone thought about this?" Whereas the ecosystem of support that goes around our festivals is a dedicated team thinking about it all the time and having the time to think strategically about what they're doing, having the time to think about what didn't work last year that they can change this year. They are they're annual projects. So I think concert promoters don't work that way, and the concert businesses are not that way. And even within Secret Sounds, the touring side sits very separate from the festival side. So I think if a concert promoter like one of us wants to get into festivals, what are you going to do? You're either going to discover some wunderkind and then build them up over many years and put a team around them.
Which is a little bit of a private equity venture capital play, right?
Well, kind of, but it's also like you're going to focus on that person as much as you're focusing on the other concerts. Whereas I think the ability for people privately to go and start to build something small that then starts to gain momentum, that they then get the funding support, wherever they get it from, just their own success, to then build it out. They're still building around that concept and around that ethos, which is why I think the reality is that all of these businesses like us in festivals have festival divisions that we generally acquire or bring in. It just makes sense.
Really good answer. That actually makes a lot of sense. So on the acquisition front then, if I look at Live Nation's currently trading about 1.1 times revenue, it's $20 billion in market cap. And to me, it unlocks 110 times, you know, earnings. To me, I think about that and I go, right, is there a formula there where you could almost print money on any acquisition? So if you were to get the right multiple. So if you were to go to a festival like Blues Fest, for example, and I know there's been some press around that, but let's just say hypothetically, you go to someone like Blues Fest and you go, right, they're making, I don't know, I'm going to guess a number, $15 million a year, $20 million a year, $30 million a year, whatever it is, right? If you can offer them half that revenue, half the revenue as an acquisition, or 0.6 times, 0.7 times, then automatically your market cap will go up on the delta. And so you're effectively printing money with any acquisition. Is that how you guys think about it? How do you guys look at acquisitions like that?
No, we look at value and growth potential. I haven't found anybody who owns anything that they simply look at the mathematical calculation and say, yeah, I agree, that's what it's worth. They always think it's worth way more. And that's good. Their blood, sweat, and tears has gone into that. And what you don't recognize in a financial sense is all of that effort that's gone into it. So that's definitely not the way. I mean, yes, there's a mathematical calculation and consideration, but a lot of the deals that we do and how far we're prepared to push them are based on what the vision is that we see strategically of having that asset in the business, and obviously the growth plan. And every business that you're talking to projects massive growth, right? Mm. So you've got to take that with a grain of salt anyway. So I personally don't see that that's the way that any of the acquisitions that I've taken forward anyway, or we've taken forward, have been viewed. It's all about the strategic imperative. It's all about, does it fill a gap? And it's about the talent.
But then, okay, so it fills a gap. It's got good talent. How are you valuing the business? How do you look at it in terms of?
You obviously look at the historical, and then you devise a multiple. You have lots of conversations with the other party about what their expectations are. Sometimes you're in a competitive environment, so that's driving it as well. Sometimes it's a vision piece where they say, well, I've got this, but this is where I want to go, and this is what I'm going to need for it. So there's no hard and fast formula. It's a good mix of, okay, what's the history? You know, how's it trended? And then a mix of what's the forecast for growth? How do we help it grow? How does it fit? And then a robust discussion to you hopefully get to a point where everyone's happy and a deal gets done. And so there's lots of different structures.
Yeah, and what doesn't come into consideration is how your own company is trading at the moment. It sounds like it.
No.
Okay, that's interesting.
Every conversation I have with Michael about an acquisition or biz dev thing is Michael Rapino is based around the strategy and the potential cost value of that particular opportunity is discussed and a factor. But there's never any indication of, oh no, I think he says often that he knows what the stock price is, but he's not driven by the stock price. That there's obviously broader macro business decisions that are made about the investments and the leverage elsewhere in the world. As we get into more building of venues, that sort of changes changes where money's being spent and how that's being approached. But it's very, very rare that something that has passed the local sort of pub test hasn't been supported. Sure, the deal might not get done, but it's definitely not ever been a factor in my world anyway.
You've said before that the events industry is built on relationships, and you've had a very long career with a very, very good and positive reputation, especially among the people that I speak to. And so I wonder if there's any tricks of the trade when it comes to building those relationships. Particularly my question is, have you ever almost burnt a bridge and then been able to make sure that it didn't get burnt?
Oh, yeah. I think anyone who hasn't done that, certainly in this business, burnt bridges.
Were they bridges you didn't need anymore, though?
No, I think we're in a challenging and emotional business. I like liking people and I like to be liked. So I guess I've got one of those personalities where I immediately feel, I feel guilty about a blow up or I feel bad if I've upset someone. I've definitely had a lot of sharp corners knocked off over my years too. So I think I'm hopefully easier to get on with than I was at times. I've had bust ups, but then been able to rebuild. And look, you get fired all the time, and I think it's really important in the small world that we're in to not go into the petulant world of cold shouldering people when you see them. You run into people all the time, and it's that sort of stuff's just awkward.
What do you put the rebuild down to?
Just being nice. Just try and be nice. I mean, look, if someone makes a business decision and then you decide to hold a grudge personally over a business decision, then you're mixing business with, it's a nasty world. And I just think we have enough challenges, all of us as individuals in this industry, in this business and in life, to not then try and make it vexatious just in the social setting. And I think that's something that I value greatly between my contemporaries. And even, I had a really fantastic relationship with Michael Gudinski. I have a great relationship with Chuggy, even though he tries to flay me publicly whenever he can. But we have fun and we laugh. And I think that's really important. That's actually what makes the business tolerable a lot of the time. But you're always going to have bust ups, and you're always going to think you did a better job than someone else did. And you're always going to take umbrage at getting that sort of criticism, especially if you perceive it to be unfair. But you've got to move on, because there's plenty of other. I think one of the big dangers is you neglect other good relationships because you're focused on one that's not good. Just if it's not working or it's bad, just don't waste your time and move on.
Roger, in prep for this podcast, I listened back to the podcast we did 4 or 5 years ago, and I fucking loved it. And I think the fact that you're so transparent, you obviously love everything that you do. You've built an incredible business here for Live Nation. And I love how open you are. No question scares you off. It's very, very inspiring. We're very grateful to have you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, I just want to say I haven't built the business. I've had a lot of people around me for a long time that have been critical contributors to that. I'm just the guy that gets to do this sort of stuff instead of sitting doing real stuff. So, it would be remiss of me not to acknowledge them and acknowledge the opportunity that I'm given, which I value every day. So, I'm happy to sit down and chat.
Thank you, Roger.
Cheers.
Thank you.